This is the third day of this January 2015 Rohatsu 7-day session. And we'll return to the collected talks of Japanese Zen Master Basui from the 14th century. And our text again today is Mud and Water, translated by Arthur Braverman. We left off yesterday where Basui was responding to a question about karmic affinity, whether karmic affinity with a teacher, karmic affinity with a particular practice, with the Dharma. And he left off saying, there is no one who does not have a karmic inclination toward the true Dharma. He says, what ordinary person does not have karmic inclination for the way? And the last thing I said, it's maybe worth repeating, is that we ourselves are the way. The way isn't some abstract thing, path out there apart from us. It's the very nature of the way, that there's nothing apart from it. And he says, there is no ice or snow apart from water. The Buddhahood of ordinary people can be likened to snow and ice melting and becoming water. From the beginning, nothing has ever been lost. If one says he has no karmic inclination toward the right Dharma and first wants to practice a method to make this karmic connection, it is like a wave in the ocean searching for the ocean, saying it has no karmic inclination toward it, and hence must seek out a means of making this connection. So it is with Buddhas and ordinary people. Always remember, when we see the word Buddhas, it means enlightened ones. Ordinary people, this might be the translator's rendering of so-called unenlightened people. So it is with Buddhas and ordinary people. They are like the water and its waves. Though they are not separated by as much as the width of a hair, because of the one mistaken thought, I am deluded, I am unenlightened, they think that enlightenment is difficult to realize. The way of Zen began without the establishment of any sect. It is simply a religion which points to the one original mind of all Buddhas and ordinary people. You could also say it's simply a practice. We don't need to bring in religion. It is a practice which points to the original mind of all Buddhas and ordinary people. This mind is nothing other than Buddha nature. To see this nature is what is meant by practice. When you realize your Buddha nature, wrong relationships will instantly disappear. Words will be of no concern. The dust of the Dharma will not stain you. This is what is called Zen. Attaining Zen is becoming a Buddha. This real Buddha is none other than the heart of all beings, the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving. The dust of the Dharma would mean the peripheral features of the Dharma, which one can get attached to. The rituals, the the doctrine. Questioner, it is said that one who practices the way will remove obstructing demons. If one simply practices Zazen and doesn't chant sacred words from sutras, by what grace will he remove these obstructions? Demons is the 14th century way of expressing these psychological complexes, these fears, anxieties, afflictions. So the questioner is asking, if you don't do the chanting, how can you have these obstructions removed, these afflictions removed? Now, just a word of explanation here. There are schools of Buddhism that insist that chanting Dharani, which we of course do, this most if not all Zen centers chant the Shosaimyo and the Daishin Dharani, the two that we do, and I think that some Buddhists attribute more magical powers to these kinds of chants. And this questioner is getting at that. How can you be freed from your afflictions? Basui, a robber does not break into the home of a poor child. The cave of demons and heretics, on the other hand, is rich with human egos and analytical thoughts. Clearly seeing into one's nature is called practice, and the seat that puts an end to analytical thoughts is called Zazen. When analytical thoughts are forgotten, views based on knowledge are also forgotten, leaving no trace of ego. The path where heavenly beings fulfill their desire to offer flowers no longer exists. Let me stop and sort of try to clear this up a little bit. Beginning where he begins by saying, a robber does not break into the home of a poor child. Zen is the primary purpose of Zen practice is to empty the mind, to free ourselves from mental attachments. And what Basui is saying, and will continue to say here, is that if we are not attached to ideas of this and that, of self and other, we're not attached to divisions in the mind, then we will be, there's nothing in us that can be hooked through these mental afflictions. The cave of demons and heretics is rich with self, with these notions of self and other and discriminating thoughts. This is the ground of these kind of problems that can come up. So he says when we're free of these analytical thoughts, then we are purified of the sticky mental stuff that can get us into trouble. And then he refers to this the path where heavenly beings fulfill their desire to offer flowers no longer exists. An explanation for that. This refers to a monk from the 600s, a monk who is said to have been so, his practice was so deep and strong that birds were said to have come and offered flowers while he was doing his meditation on the mountain. Here the version is heavenly beings came to offer flowers to him. And then he had a yet deeper realization, a great enlightenment, at which point the birds or the heavenly beings are said to have stopped coming. This points to the transcendent nature of Zen, or at least how in Zen what we aspire to is ultimately is to become nothing special, nothing exotic, nothing magical. The highest way is a transparency, clarity that would draw no such creatures, birds or heavenly beings to one. So in other words, it's like becoming invisible, absolutely empty. He continues, there is no gate through which demons and heretics can secretly enter. What special incantation can compare with this? So Basui here is rejecting the magical and the mysterious and the idea of magical powers that come from doing particular rituals. It is said in a sutra, and then this is the Diamond Sutra, on perceiving that the five skandhas are empty, one is saved from all kinds of pain and misfortune. And then Basui says, that is why the special incantations cannot be compared with diligent practice of Zazen. In other words, seeing into our true nature, awakening, is what protects us, if you want to use that word, what liberates us from the vulnerabilities of pain and misfortune. This is a classic Zen teaching. It's not for everybody. There are people who want special powers and the exotic and the colorful. It's very very different style than Tibetan Buddhist practices, for example. That's why there's this old saying in Zen that in Zen we have nothing. No saints, no gods. And then we're skipping some pages here, and he pursues this further. The questioner says, what does it mean when someone carves an image of a stupa or a Buddha figure and makes rubbings from it daily, calling it religious practice? And Basui said, this too is seeing into one's own nature. When you realize your own Buddha nature by yourself, the seal will be transmitted. And then he quotes a sutra. One look at a stupa and you are eternally separated from the three evil paths. And he says, if one were to take these teachings from the Buddhist sutras literally and give discourses on them to others, and if these people were to believe this literal interpretation, they would think that every look at a stupa would bring them prolonged freedom from evil paths. They would then feel they need do nothing more than look upon an existing material stupa. If, as is written in this sutra, one look upon a stupa will bring prolonged freedom, who, birds and beasts as well as humans, would not look upon a stupa? And would anyone fall into the three evil paths? Again, as we read yesterday, the three evil paths are the three lowest of the six realms of unenlightened existence, hell, hungry ghosts, and animals. And if this literal interpretation of the sutra were true, why would anyone be afraid to misbehave? And why would anyone throw away the pleasures of this world to become a monk or a nun, follow the precepts, perform ascetic practices, and search for a good teacher? As for this statement, a look at a stupa brings prolonged freedom from the three evil paths, it means that one who looks directly into his inherent nature will attain prolonged liberation. Questioner, there is not one among the good teachers from ancient times up to the present who hasn't said that there is no Buddha existing outside of the mind. I think, is more meaningful to those of us in contemporary Western culture. If we remember that Buddha means enlightened ones, there is no enlightened one apart from the mind. The questioner continues, though it is clear from this that all phenomena are delusion, I am not able to let go of that belief in the existence of phenomena. Is this a result of lingering habits from my mind? Just a word here. The questioner is bringing up the core experience of Buddhism and Zen, which is the realization of the emptiness of all phenomena. That yes, we live in this world of phenomena. Phenomena is everything, physical, mental, every kind of phenomena. But that from the point of view of our essential nature, there's no substance, no persistent ongoing substance to any phenomenon, even physical things, much less states of mind. So he asks, I can't let go of believing in phenomena, that this platform is something, there's something to it. It's only half the truth. Yes, it very much appears solid and has a continuing nature to it, but that ultimately, in the deepest sense, that we cannot realize with the senses, with our ordinary senses, there's nothing to anything. So Basui says, you are unable to dismiss lingering habits simply because you are not looking into your own nature. If you clearly penetrate this truth of seeing into your own nature, arousing the great Prajna wisdom, and realizing that all names and forms are illusion, you will never again have feelings of attachment to either existence or emptiness. And speaking of Prajna, we chant this every day in the Prajna Paramita. The Bodhisattva saw the emptiness of all five skandhas, that is, the emptiness of the self and all of its constituents. And later in the same chant, form here is only emptiness. That's what the questioner is asking about, and Basui is answering. Hence it is said in a sutra, when you know it as illusion, you are at that moment detached from it and have no need for any expedient means. And then Basui continues, if you try to remove lingering habits that come from attachment to form, not yet having seen into your own nature, you are like one in deep sleep trying to rid himself of a dream. So again, Basui insists on the absolute importance of seeing the formlessness of all forms, awakening, realizing that this world of things that we so easily become attached to, caught in, that it's really ultimately nothing, and that until we confirm that through our own experience, through Kensho, then we will always be behind the curveball. We will always be vulnerable to our attachments and the actions and reactions that come out of our attachments to phenomena, to the notion of a self. Again, if you try to remove lingering habits, any kind of habits, mental habits, physical habits, if you try to remove lingering habits that come from attachment to form, but haven't seen into your own nature, you are like one in deep sleep trying to rid himself of a dream. The desire to rid oneself of it is itself a dream. The knowledge that it is a dream is also nothing but a dream. As for completely waking up from this sleep, no matter how much you seek something within a dream, you will never attain it. And then he quotes the Buddha, all karmic paths are like dreams, illusions, bubbles, and shadows. They are like a dewdrop or a flash of lightning. Thus shall you think of it. So the evanescent nature of this world, the illusory nature of it, that no matter how real everything seems to be, everything mental, physical, so forth, that there is another side to it. That and experiencing, seeing into that side, the formless side, is what really is liberating. As a small glimpse into the formlessness of form is slightly liberating, and then deeper experiences of it are more fully liberating. He goes on, Bodhidharma is the living patriarch who harmonized the four elements. This old master single-mindedly transmitted the mind seal. He pointed directly to people's minds, showing them that seeing their own nature is Buddhahood. He based his teaching neither on words nor on forms. And though the Buddhas of past, present, and future, and the historical ancestors all appear in the form of living beings, not one physical body remains. They all perish. Only a word or a phrase remains in this world. Of the words they leave behind, none testifies to the reality of form. They even refute the views of emptiness and nothingness. That is, if we can become attached to concepts like emptiness and nothingness, we have to also rid ourselves of those attachments. If it is said that there were Buddhas and patriarchs who based their teaching on existence, this is completely false. What other kinds of living Buddhas and patriarchs do you believe in? If you believe in the painted and sculptured images of the ancient Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you shouldn't say you believe in living Buddhas, but rather that you simply believe in gold, silver, copper, iron, wood, rock, silk, paper, modeling clay, and the like. These paintings and sculptured images of Buddhas are all the workings of people's minds. Wooden Buddhas have never made people. What you have to realize is that mind is the mother and father of all Buddhas, the master of the 10,000 things. Here he continues to work to free the questioners and others, listeners, to free them from attachment to the form, the physical representation of the real, such as figures, Buddha figures and images. Zen Master Hakuin said, in reality, Buddhas have no form, but they are given form out of our necessity. They have no form, Buddhas. We think of Buddhas, we associate them with a certain basic form, design, or appearance. But that's what the way they have been rendered in order so they don't become too abstract, so that we think without any form that it just becomes this abstraction that then becomes elusive and impossible to relate to. This is one of the obvious differences between Islam and Buddhism. Or in Islam, you're not to give any image of the Prophet Muhammad. And that's just a recipe for attachment to abstractions, to right and wrong, good and bad. It's almost inevitable that one would get caught in these things, these abstractions, when there is no rendering of a supreme principle. So in Zen we, and in Buddhism generally, there is this understanding that as human beings we can develop more of a faith in our own Buddha nature if there is a figure of it of some kind, an image of it. But then with that comes the danger we become attached to the form. He continues, though the mind of ordinary people is clear and one with the Buddhas and patriarchs, unable to believe that you fail to rid yourself of attachment to form. Therefore, you transmigrate through the six realms, binding yourself and enduring pain. Suppose, for example, you were to arouse your aspiration and perform severe ascetic practices. If you desired to harmonize yourself with the path of no mind, while still harboring feelings of attachment to form, it would be like starting a fire by striking a rock at the bottom of the ocean. Though it is a rock at the bottom of the ocean, if you take it, put it on land, and then strike it, you will immediately produce a flame. Though every rock is equipped with the nature of fire, as long as it is submerged in water, it cannot give rise to flames. All people are equipped with the inclination to spiritual awakening, yet without removing the feeling of attachment to form, they cannot give rise to this awakening. So, again and again, he reminds us that it's mental attachment to appearances, that obstructs our awakening to the true nature of ourselves, to nature of reality. When we're attached to the appearance of things and the names that are assigned to different forms, different things, then we make a whole world out of these names, and we get caught in discrimination. So another way of putting all this is that discrimination is what prevents us. Our attachment to discrimination prevents us from seeing what is beyond two-ness, what is beyond division. Name and form is a very common expression in Buddhism, because you don't really have different forms except with different names. So they really pretty much go together, name and form, and they create this world of divisions, of this fragmented world that we come to believe in, and then from that comes a lot of suffering. We don't see the underlying unity, the oneness, that which is indivisible. And then he segues from that into sectarianism. He says, not having attained enlightenment, a person holds on to name and form, praising himself and claiming his dharma to be the one dharma. And by the way, we can just expand this into different religions. All of the suffering and violence that comes from discriminating among different religions. He says that certain teachings are to be revered while the rest are inferior. Though insisting on the one at the source, in trying to bring his thoughts into harmony with the one, he divides it into two. Though ice and boiling water, for example, were both originally cool water, ice remains hard if it is not melted, and hot water remains so, if not cooled down, and neither can be used in the place of cool water. Or take the example of people tasting the same fragrant tea. If one swallows something foul-smelling, it will interfere with the taste of the tea and he won't be able to smell its fragrance. Whatever the sect, if he clings to its dharma, he will never be in harmony with the way, not even in his dreams. If you have cataracts in your eyes, flowers seem to fall from the sky in disarray. Hence it is said in a sutra, if even the dharma must be discarded, how much more so will that which contradicts the dharma? Again and again in Zen, to let go, discard, get rid of our attachments to things, ideas, concepts, which interfere with our seeing things as they are. Dharma, he says, dharma is inward realization. Non-dharma consists of formal aspects, such as name and form, writings and sayings, and so forth. These, by the way, when you look at it, these are what divide religions from one another and also create sectarianism within a religion. Look at the Sunni and Shia nightmare, quarreling over doctrinal points and I don't know what else, but they become these tremendous points of conflict and violence. Whether the attachment is to the inner or outer, it always refers to the me. Again, the Diamond Sutra says, give birth to the mind which has no dwelling place. Or another rendering is, arouse the mind without its abiding anywhere. Basui says, if one says he is Buddha, he dwells in Buddha. If he says he is an ordinary person, he dwells in the realm of ordinary people. Moreover, from the Zen sect to the Pure Land sect, if you cling to the teaching of any one sect, you will dwell in that teaching. When your whole body has no dwelling place, what is this mind? Focus your eyes on this right now. If you truly want to know the scent of tea, you should first purify your mouth so that no other flavor or scent remains. If you want to realize the Buddha Dharma, you must first get rid of the thoughts of one who clings to the Buddha Dharma and instantly return to your original face. And so we have our particular practice, each one of us, that is for one purpose, to help us empty the mind of all of these attachments, these discriminations, these names, these concepts, these labels, religious labels, different Buddhist labels. We're trying to get beyond all such designations and see the reality that is beyond words. What is that? What is mu? The breath, too, is to the degree that we are absorbed, we are one with the breath, we will find that ideas and words slip off us and are no problem. We come to experience this great, vivid reality that is not bound in words. The thing itself, the direct experience, mind without words and concepts. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.